1774 for details. And hey, if you enjoyed Fresh Hop Cinema today, you can now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. Thanks for listening.
Hello, this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Having a little transmitter problem, so if you're hearing me, you're on the internet, kzfr.org. If you have family or friends who listen to the radio, give them a call and tell them, hey, you got to switch to the internet to listen to KZFR today. Okay, this is Ken Logan, and we're going to do the doctor's in a minute. Let's listen a little bit to Loudon Wainwright III, his song "The Doctor," and then we'll be right back with the doctor's in.
I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Son, you look older than me, and I'm 71. You're falling apart. You're not living right." I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Loud, you got to stop hanging out with that old in crowd. Living's a battle, and you're losing the fight." I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Boy, your body is a temple. It's not a toy. Fill up this here paper cup and give it to the nurse."
Thank you, Mr. Wainwright. And again, this is Ken Logan and The Doctor's Inn. And The Doctor's Inn is a show I do the third Thursday of each month where I talk about medical or health stuff that I think you're interested in. I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a minute. First of all, I want to thank Megan Hammer doing the engineering for the show today. Thank you, Megan. And I want you to know the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And now, let me tell you who the underwriters are. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or to have your event listed, visit friendsoftheart.net. And by Drunken Dumpling in Chico, first created as a food cart, Drunken Dumpling is now a dine-in restaurant serving locally sourced, fresh, homemade Asian fusion comfort food at 1414 Park Avenue, Suite 120, just behind Nobby's. Open 11 to in the morning to 9 in the night. Details on Facebook, Instagram, and on the internet at drunkendumplingchico.com. Drunken Dumpling, where they love food, flavor, and our community. Okay. So, today's show, I'm a family doctor, a primary care doctor. The radio show The Doctor's Inn exists because of the presence, the existence of this station, KZFR, and its mission, and its board of directors and staff. Of course, KZFR is a community radio station belonging to us, the community, not owned by a profit-oriented corporation or anything of the kind. Because KZFR is community radio and because of its mission, I'm thankfully able to do this radio show every month, and I thank KZFR for that, and you, the supporters, the listeners. My goal of this radio show is, The Doctor's Inn, is to teach and to share ideas, expand on ideas, maybe do some explaining of subjects, medical and health, that might be a tad bit complicated. Again, my goal is to teach. And not only teach listeners, but here's something, also teach myself. Because by exploring these health and medical subjects I do for the show, I too become taught. I feel it's a win-win situation on this show. It helps my brain. And I hope it can be of some help to your mind and brain as well. And also, help other aspects of our health, including our physical health. So that's my goal of the Doctor's Inn. So on today's show, I hope we'll all be realizing some facts together that relate to this time of year and what that brings to us relative to our health. And then I'm going to also talk about some health and medical stuff that's not seasonal at all. Remember, first, again, I'm a primary care doctor, so I have to make sure that I do the best to get us on the same page relative to two current infections. And I know you know what I'm going to say next, but please listen. They're viruses, two viruses. Yes, that means COVID viruses, plural, and influenza. I suspect you're tired of hearing this stuff. You know, I understand that disgust and that negative vibes that are part of that whole subject. However, in my defense, let's put the word disgust where it really belongs, and that's with the darn viruses. They're the disgusting things, not me. Now, you know, I realize that I'm disgusting too, but I'm not as disgusting as those viruses. These disgusting viruses have put themselves here. Now let's all make sure we're dealing with them as best we can. It's important. It's important for each of us as individuals, and let's all remember, it's also important for our community. So here I am, dipping into the viruses again, COVID and influenza, both respiratory viruses. That is, they mainly infect our respiratory tracts, and therefore their symptoms of COVID and influenza are similar. Also, these symptoms overlap with symptoms of other generally less severe viruses, such as the common cold, rhinovirus, and then respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, is present in our community now for babies, young children, at this time of year. Therefore, it can be tricky to know what exactly is causing the infection in any particular person. I want you to know that from a doctor's point of view. We have to consider a variety of factors when we're attempting to zero in on the cause of a particular person's respiratory illness. I want us to all know that we healthcare providers in this time of year usually cannot tell the difference, or often cannot tell the difference between a COVID infection and somebody who may have influenza. At least right off the bat. Often, in order to differentiate between the two, lab testing would need to be done. And there are tests for COVID, of course, and there are tests for influenza. There's even a co-test where you get both points of data. Okay, these virus infections suck. That's a medical term, suck. Not only do we not feel well with them, but they're often difficult to treat. And this is, again, me talking as a doctor. It can be so difficult to help people through some of these infections. We generally don't have antibiotics against viruses, generally speaking. So virus infections are usually very challenging when it comes to helping people. We can maybe help some of the symptoms, but we have much less ability to help them fight the viral infections. I probably don't have to remind you of how the severity of COVID virus infections is with many people in the world. Around 800,000, so more than 750,000 have died in the U.S. since this pandemic began, and many, many other people have long-term consequences, long-haul COVID, with problems in their lungs, brain, heart, and other tissues. Influenza can also be nasty, but the picture looks a bit different for influenza. That is, the deaths from influenza, at least in our country, are generally closer to the 30,000 to 50,000 per year, as opposed to the 400 or so thousand per year deaths of COVID. However, one interesting difference that I think you all should know on influenza is, again, the deaths, 30 to 50,000 in the United States every year. The bulk of those deaths are in the elderly. However, the other peak, it's not as many, but the other peak of deaths is in children. And 80% of those kids who get in, who die from influenza each year, are unvaccinated to influenza. 80% of them are unvaccinated to influenza. And there is not, at least to my knowledge, any kind of long-term, usually not long-term influenza like there is in many people that have long-term symptoms from COVID. Therefore, the reason I bring it up like this is, therefore, and those issues about us not being able to help people very well when they get an infection from a virus, it becomes of utmost importance to do our best as human beings to prevent viral infections. That's how we handle them. To prevent, we do prevention. Another reason that it's of utmost importance to tackle these respiratory viruses by utilizing methods of prevention is because many of them, we have to take steps on prevention because they're very, very contagious, readily passed from person to person, right? And remember this, the newer COVID virus, the Omicron, is even more infectious than the Delta, which was more infectious than the original. So here again, I'm talking about prevention. I just can't stress the importance of prevention. I just can't. So I'm going to say more about it. Again, please listen. In my mind, there's two different categories, two categories of prevention when it comes to helping ourselves battle these respiratory viruses. Two general categories of prevention. First is contact prevention, and I'll talk about that more in a minute. I think you know, but I'm going to talk about it specifically more in a minute. The second one is zeroing our immune systems in on each of the most worrisome viruses, that is COVID and influenza this time of year. Mainly this means vaccinations relative to COVID virus and influenza viruses. Okay, back to the contact prevention. It involves common sense and a simple idea that since these respiratory viruses are so contagious, so spreadable from person to person, it's very important to do our best to avoid spreading the virus around as best we can. This, of course, means when someone has one of these viruses, they know they have it, whether they're sick or not sick, and just carrying the virus and don't have symptoms, at least yet, that person carrying the virus can spread it to another person, of course, even if they don't have symptoms. That means two specific things. People who know they have the virus infection need to isolate themselves from anyone else. How long to isolate from other people when you have a known case of COVID, you might ask? Well, for COVID, once you are a known infected person, that means you should isolate yourself for 10 days. That is 10 days from the first day of symptoms or 10 days from the day you were diagnosed, that is tested and diagnosed. If you were tested after your symptoms began, then I don't know. Either I think you should go with the day you started having your symptoms. But if you don't have the test and you just feel darn sure you have COVID, then you should isolate yourself for 10 days from the starting day of your symptoms. Okay, and again, for those of us all who don't have known COVID and have not been exposed to someone recently who does have COVID or influenza, it's still advised, therefore, in other words, we don't know, we don't have COVID and we haven't been exposed that we know of, it's still important now because of Delta and Omicron being so spreadable. It's important for all of us now, at this time, what is today, December 16th, 2021, to mask in public. When you're around other people, mask. And in a minute, we're going to talk about other people, being around other people. But mask when in public. Physically distance yourself from other people when in public. And the third thing is stay away from crowds. Think of crowds as virus factories. Therefore, stay away from virus factories. Okay, here's a problem. We're heading into the holidays this time of year. Oh my God. Still, please avoid crowds. Even when masked, please avoid crowds. Do it again this year like we did last year. Please avoid crowds. It will save lives, including maybe saving grandma or grandpa's lives this holiday season. Remember, the COVID variant that we mostly have currently is the Delta, and now Omicron. They're both very contagious. Yep. All right. There. That was contact prevention information. Now to the second category of prevention. And what is that going to be? The second category of prevention? Yes, you're right. Vaccinations. That means COVID and influenza. But I'm going to start with COVID. But first of all, vaccinations are how we are already keeping some of the other viruses away from us in this country and in the world. And what viruses are we already vaccinating and therefore have kept away from us mostly or largely in this country and the world? Poliovirus, mumps, measles, whooping cough, rubella, rabies. These we have kept down rabies in certain conditions, certain situations, that is. So we have kept these down because of vaccinations. We've learned that. Now we need to continue that with this virus called COVID and annually the influenza. So since COVID virus can be so severe in certain people, remember, killed 800,000 of us so far, and can cause also long-term problems. And you, if you've ever talked to anybody who has long-term problems from having a COVID infection, long-term problems for the rest of their life, possibly, at least years, in lungs, brain, or heart, if you talk to somebody with that, you'll see what I mean. So, listen to this. So, here, I hear about how severe that, I hear about how we have vaccinations to other viruses like polio, mumps, measles, rubella, how we've kept them down because of vaccination. And then I say, oh, you know what? Wouldn't it be great if we had vaccination options against COVID? Oh, wait a minute. We do have vaccination options against COVID. Well, maybe I think I don't need COVID vaccination because I think I'll just fight it off. Or I'll get COVID and I'll be a little, I'm a healthy guy, so maybe I'll get sick for a while and then that'll be it. Oops. Wait a minute. If I get COVID, even if I'm going to fight it off just fine, just be sick for a couple of weeks, I'm still going to be passing it off to other people. I'm going to be spreading it around our community, allowing other people to get sick, maybe die, maybe get heart problems, cardiomyopathy, brain problems, encephalopathy, blood clots, various places in their body, or chronic lung disease. Let me think this over again. So let's see. If I get vaccinated, not only would it help me not get sick, but I'd be helping other people from getting COVID. I'd be potentially helping some people not die. I'd be helping potentially other people from to end up with long-term COVID. I'd be helping them not get cardiomyopathy, brain problems, stroke, lung disease. Wow. Gosh, I think that alone is worth me getting the vaccination. Even if it doesn't help me, I can help prevent health disasters in other people. Okay. Yeah, I think I'll get vaccinated against COVID. And don't we know, COVID vaccine originally, if you got it originally when the vaccine was out, well, it's time now for a booster. Booster is important. Getting a COVID booster for everyone. I had a patient the other day, a couple days ago, asked me, he was a 21-year-old, and he says, I don't know, booster, you think I ought to? I go, are you a human being? And he appropriately said, yes. Then I said, we all should get boosters. All of us. It's necessary. Probably best with Pfizer or Moderna. Johnson & Johnson, I'm sorry to say, is something I do not advise. I think the FDA, or rather the CDC, may be coming out with an opinion about Johnson & Johnson versus, you know, rating it against Pfizer and Moderna in the near future. I just read that. I don't care saying it. I'm a doctor. I know darn good and well it's best to get the Pfizer or Moderna. The mRNA technology is needed, is helpful. Where it's needed, the mRNA, messenger RNA technology that is allowed for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine or biotech vaccines one of the benefits of them is that they're much quicker to create and produce in the lab. They don't require cell cultures like the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines take time, more time to make the doses. Messenger RNA like Pfizer and Moderna biotech are made rather briskly and could be ramped up for worldwide distribution quickly. So, therefore, what needs to happen with that messenger RNA or mRNA Pfizer and Moderna biotech vaccines? They need to drop this ownership of the technology. And our country needs to make, since they're in our country, that our country politically, President Biden, needs to, and Congress both, need to make sure that Pfizer and Moderna, especially Moderna, because there's your tax dollars, my tax dollars, your tax dollars helped with the formulation, the bit work of formulating and producing Moderna biotech vaccine, COVID vaccine. Our tax dollars are part of that. They need to drop the ownership of that technology, allow worldwide. I just heard on Democracy Now! A guy came on and talked about there would be 120 places or laboratories across the world that could do would be quickly able to be up and running to make those mRNA COVID virus vaccinations if the ownership of that technology was dropped by Moderna, for sure, and Pfizer, one would hope. By the way, that was on Democracy Now! From today's. The 16th of December, Democracy Now!, if you want to go back and hear that. Anyway, there. I guess I just really gave you my opinion about that stuff, didn't I? So the bottom line is we're in a worrisome time right now with infectiousness of these COVID viruses has greatly increased. And once Omicron gets all over us, the COVID rates are going to be gigantic. We're going to have major, we're already seeing it, but major, major surges again. Now, it may not be quite as sickening, but it will be sickening. You'll still get sick. It'll still take you out for a week or two, but it may not put you in the hospital as likely. Doesn't mean it won't, but not as likely. Listen to this. Inlow, as of yesterday, 15 COVID patients in the hospital as of yesterday, Friday. No, I mean Wednesday. Sorry, Wednesday the 15th. Well, 93% of those COVID patients that were sick enough to require hospitalization were not fully vaccinated. In other words, essentially unvaccinated. 93% of the hospitalized COVID patients. Is there a message there for anybody? Get vaccinated. That's the advice. And remember, like I said earlier, when you vaccinate against a virus such as COVID, fully vaccinated, and get a booster now, by the way, and get influenza, you're helping yourself. But guess who you're actually helping even more? The community, and the more likely to be sick people in the community. Both jobs of the vaccination are important. Thank you for listening on that. Now, I'm going to start in, maybe in the middle of this next section, we're going to take a little break, but I'm going to start in this, or should we take a little break right now? Hey, let's take a little break. We're going to listen to we won't take a very long break, but we'll listen to the Rolling Stones' Dear Doctor for just a minute or two.
Okay. Dear Doctor, take one, right.
Oh, help me, please, Doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's beating. Can't you please take it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Oh, help me, please, Mama, I'm sickening. It's today, that's the day I'm to plunge. Oh, the gal I'm to marry is a bull. I've been soaking a drink like a sponge. Don't you worry.
All right. Thank you, Rolling Stones. That was Dear Doctor. And thank you, Megan. Oh, now, the next subject that I'm going to cover here, there's some recent recommendations, changes on this subject. So I thought it was important to talk about this subject for women. And this is cervical cancer screening, some recent recommendation changes. I'm going to talk a little pro and con on this, but I'm going to let you know what they are, the changes are. First, I'm going to talk about what cervical cancer is, and I'm actually first going to even talk about what the cervix is. You know, what is it? Where is it? And then how common is cervical cancer, cancer of the cervix? I imagine that most female listeners know where a person's cervix is. Men don't have it. Women have it. But there may be some men listening to this show. You never know. Well, for you men, I'm going to tell you what a cervix is right now. First of all, you got to know this. When we healthcare providers say the word cervical, and by the way, this term is cervical cancer screening of this part of my show, cervical cancer screening. But I want you to know that when we doctors and other healthcare providers or anybody in the healthcare field says cervical, sometimes we're talking about the neck. I just want you to know that. The neck, you know, or the spine of a neck of a human. So a word such as cervical spine means the spine of the neck. But when we're talking about the term, cervical cancer, we're talking about a part of a female body. Now, that's the area where a woman's uterus opens into the upper area of the vagina. It's called the cervix. It's the area that dilates or opens up when gets bigger, dilates up. When a woman is in the process of giving birth to a baby, the cervix dilates during labor, allowing the baby, which is in the uterus, to pass into the vaginal canal and then be born. So that's where the cervix is. So cancer of the cervix, of course, then, is one of the cancers that affect women. Cancer of the cervix is not as common as cancer of the breast, or in men and women, not as common as cancers of the lungs or colon. However, or prostate in men. However, it's apparently estimated, and this is from an article in JAMA, or the Journal of the American Medical Association, from the 7th of this month, December 7th, 2021, volume 326, number 21, this information about cervical cancer that I'm telling you right now. So they said it apparently... It's estimated that this year, 2021, when we tally up at the end of 2021, there will be somewhere between 14 to 15,000 cases of cervical cancer diagnosed in the United States this year. And of that 14 to 15,000 women, Somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 women in the U.S. will die from cervical cancer, that cancer. The percentage of women who end up with cervical cancer and then die was much higher many, many years ago, before we began doing cervical cancer screening in this country and around the world. Screening, that's, and it has been, fortunately, available for many, many years. So, fortunately, with cervical cancer screening, it can be found early, or even better, it can be found when there are changes in the cells of the cervix that can lead, that we feel will lead, likely, to cancer and be treated to prevent the cancer from happening. That's why it was so much of a killer before. And let me tell you this, speaking of so much of a killer, I read also that in Africa, currently in the continent of Africa, relative to women, in the continent of Africa currently, cervical cancer is the number one cancer killer, before breast, before lung, before colon. It is the biggest killer of women in Africa. So they really should have cancer screening for cervical cancer there. Okay, so screening for cervical cancer, the name of the test is called a pap smear, P-A-P, pap smear. And why would it be called pap smear? Well, the word smear means that some cells from the cervix are put on a slide and looked under the microscope. That's only part of a pap smear today, which I'm going to tell you more about the other part of a pap smear that is needed in just a minute. But what's the word pap mean, P-A-P? Well, I'm going to tell you. It's because because of Dr. Georgios Nikolai Papanikolaou. Georgios Papanikolaou, a Greek physician who immigrated to the United States actually in 1913 and was a pioneer in cytopathology, in other words, looking at cells under the microscope and determining the features that were cancer and leading to cancer in cervix and other things. So he was quite a pioneer in that technology. And again, this was in the early parts of the 1900s. And in 1961, he was invited to the University of Miami to lead and develop the Papanikolaou Cancer Research Institute there. Thank you, Giorgio Papanikolaou. Or pap smears. Okay. However, over the years, here's one important change recent of over the last several years. This is important, very important. And that's not only are the cells looked at under the microscope, something we call cytology. And so a pap smear is done during a woman's pelvic exam. It's not the obtaining of cells from the outside of the cervix during a pelvic exam is not. I'm not a woman, so I've not had a pelvic exam, but I will say from my point of view, I'm biased, I'm a male, but I will say having a pap smear, the obtaining of cervical cells at a pap smear is not a, it's not a surgery or a major procedure. It's a relatively simple procedure to do. And the cells, again, are looked at under the microscope as part of the pap smear, and we call that cytology, or looking at the cells for are they looking like they're going to turn to cancer, or are they early cancer, and then get treated early. But over the last few years, this much more and additionally very important finding has come up that the bulk of cervical cancer of the cervix, is caused by another virus. Human papillomavirus. Now, human pap or HPV. Now, there are many, many variants or strains of human papillomavirus, vast majority of them have nothing to do with cancer. However, there's a few strains that are more likely than any of the other strains to lead to cervical cancer. So, and the bulk of the causes, the bulk of the cases of cervical cancer are caused by one of those few human papillomavirus, HPV viruses. Therefore, determining if a woman has those HPV viruses at the cells of the cervix is very important relative to preventing or treating early and preventing cervical cancer. So part of the pap smear nowadays should include HPV testing, not just cytology, looking at the cells. As a matter of fact, sometimes women will have just the HPV testing and not do the cytology, the looking under the microscope. Who decides that is the healthcare provider. There's not a different, there's no increased steps to the actual pelvic exam, pap smear, taking of cells of the, just outer cells of the cervix onto, at the time of the pelvic exam. So relative to whether or not a woman has the HPV test or the cytology test or both, the pelvic exam part is no different. There is no difference. So there's nothing else additionally involved in the actual pelvic exam, so it won't bother you anymore. It is up to the healthcare provider to order one or both of those tests at the time they send that to the lab. My advice, am I jumping the gun on my advice? Well, let me see. So the HPV part is very important. Now, let me talk to you now. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Now I want to talk about the recommendations that are recent. And that has to do with a woman's, the advice of when to start having pap smears, what age, and the frequency or how often to get a pap smear done. Those are the things that have changed. Those recommendations have changed a little bit recently. When we look at that, these recommendations, though, we first need to pay attention as to whether or not the advice we're talking about is for pap smears in the female general public. In other words, women who don't have any certain risk factors for cervical cancer. They're just the average woman. Or because there are some medical conditions where these recommendations I'm going to tell you in a minute are not the case. They need more specific recommendations for their pap smear. These women in these kinds of medical conditions I'm going to say right now. And those medical conditions are women who've had a past abnormality on their pap smear. These recommendations that I'm going to tell you in a minute don't include her. She needs to talk with her healthcare provider about how often and what testing and how often it should be done. We're going to unique for her. Also unique testing needs to be done for women who have had tissue transplants of solid organs. That is, any woman who's had kidney transplant, liver transplant, heart transplant, or have transmitted transplants of bone marrow or stem cells, like some women who've had leukemia or lymphoma, for instance. Those women they need to have their healthcare provider tell them how early to start having PAPs and how often to have them. Women with HIV infection also are not in this general category. They too need to talk to their healthcare provider specifically. Immunosuppression from other causes, such as medicines, such as chemotherapy for cancer, but also there are people nowadays, this is in recent years, who have rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or some cases of severe psoriasis, for instance, who might be on pills or other medications by their rheumatologist or other doctor that are immunosuppressive. They suppress the immune system. They help your rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or psoriasis symptoms, but that puts that woman into a different category. She needs a different plan for her PAP. Therefore, women with those medical conditions are advised to have SMAPs, probably have PAP smears done more often and possibly to start at a younger age than the general public of women. Therefore, specifically talk to your healthcare provider if you're in one of those categories because you need unique advice. Now, here's the general public female's changes in advice. First of all, what age to start having pap smears? It used to be around 21. Now, the advice generally is age 25. And I could hear the 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old women going, whew, great, I get to put it off for a few years. Yeah, so now it's age 25. Regardless of whether or not, regardless of that woman's sexual history or HPV or human papillomavirus vaccination history, regardless of that. So generally, pap smears should begin around age 25. I just said something that I need to say again, and that is something very important. I already talked about vaccinations earlier in the program for other things, other viruses. Well, this virus also is important. Remember, I already said cervical cancer is caused by some varieties of human papillomavirus. So, therefore, getting vaccinated against human papillomavirus is very important. And the time when human papillomavirus enters humans, it's sexually. This one, these kind that cause cervical cancer, that and that phenomenon, it's a sexually transmitted virus in that case. And that means that girls and boys, because boys carry the virus and then pass it to the women, so is around, I believe, around the age of 12. In other words, before, generally, sexual activity. That is advised, boys and girls, all of them, all boys, all girls, around the age of 12. I'm not exactly sure what spread of ages are advised with that. Talk to your doctor, either your pediatrician or your family doc. But I do want you to know, it should be 100% of us when we're that age should get this vaccine. It didn't exist when I was that age, but now that should happen. Talk to your doctor about it. Here's another thing. You know, when you're getting a pap smear, I think a woman should advocate for herself and know what she's getting done on her pap smear. When she's getting her pap smear, I think she should know. Yeah, she should know. What did you have done? Did you have both tests, that is the cytology where they look at the cells, and the HPV or human papillomas virus testing? Did you have both or did you just have one? I hope you didn't just have the cytology, the cell thing. You better have had the HPV done. Now, some docs will do, some providers will just do the HPV, and I think that's okay. It's less important, I think, to have the cytology. Not only me, but others feel it's less important to have the cytology, the cells. But I think it is a good idea. And it's good for you to have both cytology and the HPV when you get both tests done. Again, no different. Your PAPS, your pelvic exam doesn't change your pelvic exam at all. It's just what does the doctor or provider write on the lab slip. I advise both. So here's the deal. If HPV testing is part of your pap smear, and hopefully it is, and you're negative for HPV, then it's advised for you to get your next pap smear in 5 years. It used to be 3. Now we're saying 5 years, apparently. And that's the American Cancer Society's recommendation, 5-year intervals. Now, it does turn out that, I'm just saying this because it's a little aside, from that JAMA article, that Journal of American Medical Association article from December 7th, 2021, article on this, that the HPV test needs to be what's called a primary HPV test. And they didn't go into what, and it needs to be approved as a primary HPV test. They didn't go into the details about what primary, approved primary HPV test is, but I think that's the technology has developed here over the last few years that hopefully most labs are doing that adequate or primary HPV testing. That's something your healthcare provider, you need to talk to your healthcare provider about, because if it isn't the newer technology, primary HPV testing, then it isn't 5 years advised on your repeat. It's 3 years. Or if you just happen to have, by the way, the cytology, the cells alone part of your pap smear, then it's 3 years. Every 3 years. You think that's confusing, huh? Maybe. But here's the bottom line. I say have your healthcare provider do both cytology and a primary HPV test when they do your pap smear. Have them put that on the lab slip. And if you're negative, you can do it every 5 years. If it's got some question, in other words, there's some question of HPV being present, then you're in a different category, and your healthcare doctor will, healthcare provider will talk to you about that. Ta-da! I think that's fairly straightforward. If you have any questions about this, please talk to your healthcare provider. If you have any specific questions about what I just presented, and you felt you wanted to ask me about what the heck I just said, you could contact me at my email address, klogan.md@yahoo.com. So that's the letter K and then Logan, L-O-G-A-N, md@yahoo.com. And when I answer you, tell me what your question is. If I'm not your doctor, I won't advise you specifically as an individual, but I will restate, hopefully, and help you understand what I just told you all about on this pap smear thing. So if you had any questions to me to sort out what I just told you about on pap smears, my email address is klogan.md@yahoo.com, and that's the letter K, klogan, klogan.md@yahoo.com. And of course, tell me who you are and what your question is when you email me. The next thing I'm going to talk about, the final thing I'm going to talk about on this show, and I hope I have enough time, is deaths from drug overdoses. And why in the world would I bring it up? Well, let me tell you some alarming truth first. Deaths in the United States from people overdosing on any medication has dramatically risen over the last 4 or 5 years. As a matter of fact, the deaths have doubled over the past 14 years, and most of that rise is a dramatic rise since the last 3 years or so, 4 years, three, 4 years. It's a little, it's a blatantly obvious rise, significant rise in deaths, and the amazing rise is generally, and we're talking about all drugs, but the one that's doing it really, the rise, is overdose on one of the opioids. In other words, the specific cause of this dramatic rise is opioid overdose deaths. but first, I'm going to say this. When we look at overdose, drug overdoses, remember that some are intentional, suicidal thing act. Some are unintentional. And what we're talking about on this spike of deaths is the unintentional. But first, both are horrible. Both are preventable. So first I'm going to say a little bit about the intentional drug overdose. A sad thing for me to talk about. It's, of course, where a person is attempting to, or does, take their own life. Depression and desperation, being sad and present, is horrible. And depression, as you know, is fairly common. It's common. And it's important for all of us to understand and recognize as best we can when in yourself or others, when depression is present, and what that brings forth from us, I hope, as people, fellow human beings, is understanding, caring, emotional support. Those are critically important in people who have depression, and that is persistent and ongoing. Understanding and caring and emotional support, ongoing, long term. Also, especially when suicide thoughts desires or thoughts even are present, then it's best to also, besides always being there for that person, it's also important that they seek a professional help. And that means first of all, I say their healthcare provider, but also counselors, teachers, faith professionals. It's important. Communication is important. Persistent and ongoing intervention is very important. I wish I had that suicide hotline. Gosh, I don't have that number. You could Google it. Okay, let me talk about the unintentional, this significant rise over the last 3 years or more. Fentanyl is the name of the opioid. Fentanyl and fentanyl-like opioids on the street that are causing this. Why is that? Where does that come from? Well, let me just say this word first. It's sold on the street often as something called FASH. FASH, and that's fentanyl adulterated or substituted heroin. And in other words, fentanyl is sneaking into street drugs that come from, China, India, where else was it? Other countries, China, Mexico, India, possibly the United States, where fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It's not a natural one. It's synthetic. It's made in the laboratory inexpensively. It's inexpensively made. And that's one problem. It's very, very, very potent. In other words, a little bit is a power. And so they're sneaking it into methamphetamine, to sneaking it in with heroin, even sneaking it in with cocaine. And remember, there is no FDA on street drugs, so there's no Federal Drug Administration monitoring these things. So the suppliers and the producers of street drugs, fentanyl, I'm telling you, in the United States and the world, is sneaking into these street drug supplies, and overdoses are happening. What can we do about that? I don't know any way of stopping it. One thing New York City is doing, just instituted a drug supervision public health site where street drug addicts, people who are addicted to street drugs, can utilize their street drugs in a supervised place. That's not new, but they just started that in New York City. I'm sure there's other cities and places across the world that do. It's an epidemic. Fentanyl overdose is an epidemic. Let me tell you about in Chico, the needle exchange by the Northern Valley Harm Reduction Coalition, Friday mornings, 9 to 11, no charge, no appointment, where fentanyl test strips are available. Narcan is available, no charge on this stuff, to help people test their drug supply for fentanyl and have Narcan or naltrexone available if overdose happens on someone you're next to or near you. And that needle exchange, 9 to 11 each Friday morning at 171 East 18th Street, half a block east of Park Avenue. A doctor is present. I know that for a fact. And a social worker or two are present, and they know about rehabs also. So needle exchange, Friday mornings, 9 to 11, no charge, no appointment, walk in. Phone number, 332-8065. That's 530-332-8065. You'll get a machine, and they'll leave a message. They'll call you back. So I want to talk more about that later, but I think I'm to the end of the show. And I want to tell you about an underwriter. D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and Community Radio in Northern California. They support KZFR. For more information, visit D.A. Lampe, that's L-A-M-P-E, Construction. D.A. Lampe Construction.com. Remember that the opinions on this show are mine and not KZFR underwriters or staff or board of directors or volunteers or anybody else. They're my opinions. And thank you to Megan Hammer, the engineer for this show. Thank you, Megan. And let's see. What else do I need to say? get your COVID booster for if it's time. Remember, wear a mask. Like Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Says, wearing a mask is an act of love. All right. Stay tuned now for Planetary Radio. And listen here to Dr. Wu by Steely Dan. Thanks.
Cuban gentlemen sleep all day. I went searching for the song